want to just remark that Shona is an excellent spoken word poet, yeah, and we should all be listening to her work. I won't say too much about fires, just in December last year the Cambridge Companion to Irish Poets was published. These kind of publications are seen as Bibles, they're seen as indicative of the canon of Irish literature. It contained 3 women out of a total of 40, am I right? That's a problem, but it's the reason it is because it's not an exception, and I dare any one of you to go out and find an anthology of Irish poetry that doesn't have a similar balance. So that was the last straw for a lot of us, and the wonderful Chris Murray started a movement contacting poets and us together to do something about it. So we've done kind of 2 main things. We have a pledge, it's at womanpoetspledge.com, but it's for everyone. Everyone can sign it. I can't emphasise that enough. Publishers, festival organisers, poets, people who are interested in poetry, everyone can sign it, so please do that. And it's a commitment to withdraw from any event that doesn't make a good faith attempt at gender balance. It's not a massive ask. The other thing we are doing is we're hosting a womanpoetspledge.com. The other thing we're doing is we're hosting readings and kind of discussion events around the country to introduce ourselves and each other, because it's okay not to know about these women. They've been erased from our history. So we're educating ourselves and we're educating each other. And that's why the hashtag HedgeSchool is part of this movement. We had one reading in Belfast, because I suppose it's important to say that this is an all-Ireland movement. And this is the second Irish reading. There's been a reading in Barcelona last week. And so what we're going to do is 5 of us are going to read a selection from a poet that we particularly admire, and then 1 or 2 pieces of our own work. So I hope that you enjoy. And if anyone wants to come up and ask us questions afterwards in the break, please do. I'll just finish with, one other thing, we already have a second Cork date. As part of Cork World Book Festival on April 28th, we're going to be hosting a literary trail around the city. So please come and be part of that. We will be reminding the Irish literary world about the beautiful work and talented poets who have been erased from the canon of Irish literature. We want to discuss why this happened and how we can stop it from happening. We want more than anything to celebrate these women and their words. So I'm just going to quickly introduce you to the readers, and then we're all going to read in turn. I think probably most of you know who I am. So the second reader will be Chris Murray. Chris is an Irish poet. Her chapbook, 3 Red Things, was published by Smithereens Press in June 2013. A small collection of interrelated poems in series and sequence cycles was published by Lapway in autumn 2013. A book-length poem, The Blind, was published by Oneiros Books in 2013. Her second book-length poem, She, was published by Oneiros in spring 2014. A chapbook, Signature, was published by Bone Orchard Press in March 2014. A modern encounter with Phoebus Abiarat on Evan Boland's Phoebus Was Gone, All Gone, His Journey Over, was published in Evan Boland Inside History by Ireland House in 2016. So that's our second reader. Our third reader is Raina Leon. Raina is over bringing students over from St. Mary's College, California for the San Francisco Twinning Exchange. She's a Cavic Hannon Graduate Fellow in 2006, a Canto Mundo Fellow, a Macondo Fellow, and a member of the Carolina African American Writers Collective. She's been published in numerous journals as a writer of poetry, fiction, and non-fiction. Her first collection, Canticle of Idols, was a finalist for the Cavic Hannon First Book Poetry Prize and Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. Her third book, Sombra, Dislocate, was published in 2016, as was her first chapbook, Profeta Without Refuge. A founding editor of the Essentials Review, an online quarterly international journal devoted to the promotion and publication of Latinx arts, she's also an associate professor of education at St. Mary's College of California. Our fourth reader, am I right? Yes. Is Nicola Moffat, who you guys might know. Born and raised in South Africa, Nicola has spent the last 19 years trying to become a Corkonian. We all know how difficult that is. She is a regular attendee of OVAIL and has been published in the OVAIL annual 5-word challenge anthology. She was also invited to contribute to the 2016 OVAIL Winter Warmer Festival, and her reading can be found on YouTube. And finally, a surprise guest that we got at the last minute, Kate Dempsey. Kate Dempsey's poetry is widely published in journals in Ireland and the UK, including Poetry Ireland Review and Magma. Prizes include the Plough Prize and commendations for the Hennessy New Irish Writing and the Patrick Kavanagh Award. A poem from her debut collection, The Space Between, Thera 2016, was highly commended for the Forward Prize. And that's all the reading out of biographies I'm going to do. So the poet I've chosen to read is Rhoda Coghill. You probably haven't heard of her, that's okay. As I was saying to people downstairs, many professors of Irish literature have not heard of her. She was born in 1903. She published 2 collections of poetry, The Bright Hillside in 1948 and Time is a Squirrel in 1956. She was the national accompanist for Radio Éireann from 1939 to 1969, so for 30 years, and yet no one in RTÉ knows who she is or knows her name. She was a musician and a composer. She composed a rhapsody called Out of the Cradle, Endlessly Rocking, which has been described as one of the best interwar compositions, full stop. Let's see what else I want to say about her. Oh yeah, when she sent a poem to the Dublin magazine in the 50s, the then editor Seamus O'Sullivan said that if she had, instead of using a pseudonym, signed her poem with her own name, a name which is held in honour wherever music is honoured in Ireland, he might have less cause to congratulate himself on that swift acceptance of her first submission. The other thing Seamus O'Sullivan said was that her work would definitely outlast all of the yodelers, as he described them, that were writing poetry at that time. So sadly he was wrong about that, but we're going to bring her back. We're going to bring her back to her rightful position. So I'm just going to read some poems by Cockhill. So this is called The Chestnut Tree. What crime did she, the chestnut tree, commit that she must bear the stigma of disgrace, must wear when first her gummy buds unfold to show the leaves they can no longer hold green convict's arrows? All in nature obeys an iron legislature, and the proud chestnut, like her neighbour, serves every year a year's hard labour, but she alone, of all the trees, is branded criminal. Wait till those arrows wider spread, and gay umbrellas then instead her leaves appear. All leaves her boughs, so tender that the grazing cows reach up and pull them with rough tongue. Their stems, torn from the bark, leave a horseshoe mark. When summer is here, among dark leafy feather fans blow flowers of pink and white, sweet singing towers which sudden showers batter, shatter, and scatter with mischievous patter. Until where blooms had been, the tree again is green, whereon she sheds, like the round heads of giant's clubs, rich spiky nubs from a branch rough shaken, and the place forsaken through summer's heat teems with seed, where the feet of seeking children pass and press under trampled grass, shell after nut big shell, which burst as it fell, spilling its wanton treasure for boys' brown pleasure. In an autumn world of tarnished metal blaze her peacock tails of red, green, yellow, rays of changing fire, which quite burnt out, she stands nun-like, amazed, and raises stiff gloved hands, and then, when in her rusty flame, no queenly flame, no ripened apple flush of sunset lingers, comes surging frost to amputate the fingers. The hag at last, her beauty past, is stripped, a map, a skeleton, and drinks the winter sun. Mm-hmm. This next poem is called The Young Bride's Dream. It's a short poem. I wonder, will he still be gentle when I'm fastened safe to his side? Will he buy grandeur to cover my beauty and shelter me like a bird that he'd hide in a quiet nest and show me great courtesies and make me queen of his body and all that he is? Or curse me, use me, like a chance woman, a servant, a girl that he'd hire at a fair, bid me rip my gown to 100 pieces, make rags of it then for the floors and the stair. I had warning last night, in a dream without reason or rhyme, but the words may be true ones, obedience is ice to the wine. And I'm just going to read one more, and I'm reading it because in this poem, Cockhill describes how she's going to be forgotten. She starts with a quote by Sappho, "But thou shalt ever lie dead, nor shall there be any remembrance of thee then or ever, for thou hast none of the roses of Pieria, but thou shalt wander unnoticed, even in the houses of Hades, flitting among the shadowy dead." Listen, I dare not hang a lamp in the treetops to light a flight to heaven, nor dance and sing to the gay mode that wins a cheap affection, the right of omadhons, minstrels, and fair clowns, nor play the noisy patriot's hurdy-gurdy. I have not set a footprint on that rock face where the adventurous, in the fine air achievement breathes, have waved a brave salute and disappeared to map wisdom's frontiers. Nor have I forged a strong link in the chain that grounds the anchor of heredity in distant Genesis. Have sowed no acorns to furnish future forests with proud wood. My present fingers cannot stain a canvas with the coloured flux that seems all life, all knowledge, to conjure up a universe of beauty till even fools shall gape and cry praise God. No one will seek my grave or mark the date when I shall leave the world. No one imagine my swift enrolment in the choir of saints and institute a celebration for me, a day of pious prayer and memory dedicated to the evergreen repeating of a gold calendar of worthy deeds. I do not claim a clear chorus of praise. One in my life deserves a plume of fame. But yet, although the might of time remains unmoved by my small bickering, for hawks will rest after their domination and forget the scattered feathers blossoming on the slopes, the little bloodstains sinking into clay, the stiffened claws and the dull film on eyes that saw the moon and saw no farther. Yet, what though I earn no wreath of immortelles, having no immortality in history, and bear no posthumous weight of dignity nor win a place in glory's breviary, leaving a name that echoes into silence. In some form I should be valued. When my spirit, the ghostly sap that lends its comfort to my human body, withdraws to its eternal source in the divine ground. When my dust, learning new figures in the atom's dance, has blown and settled into this planet's mass. When all this pitiful has been resolved in colour and leaf stirrings, in clover flowers, bowing before your lordly person's procession. And I'm just going to finish off with a poem of my own. So if you guys want to hear Coggle around the applause, that would be cool. It's very moving to me to be able to read her words and to have her applauded. So this poem was requested by some students of Reina's that I met earlier today. It's a curse poem because sometimes you need a curse. You know, I want to be all nice and diplomatic, but sometimes you need a curse. I read it in the style of the ancient Fili, the ancient bards of Ireland, who, when they wanted to curse someone, would stand in a certain way and their words were so magical that the curse would come true. Thus far, my curse has not come true. Maybe I'm just a nice person, I'm not sure. But maybe I'm not doing it right, I'm not sure. If you guys have people you'd like to think about for this curse, presidents, please do so. I myself am going to dedicate it to Ronan Mullen. Probable misuse of shamanism. I clamber through your great vein, or inferior vena cava as it is properly known. Surrounded by black stagnant blood and the beat of the drum, if I work hard enough, I will come to the writhing bowl of your right atrium, and then the possibilities are endless. I can sit quite still, with a choking gutful of irony wine, and allow my foreignness to disrupt the smooth flow, turbulence that is called, through the mitral valve, so that little clots form and are shot around and out to your lungs, and exercise in anticipation for me, the knowing wait for the sharp pain, the breathless death. I can kick and claw at the great central wall to make a small hole and squeeze through to the business side. From there, I will have no choice but to be shunted straight to your brain, whence a dullness will spread and the FAST protocol from the stroke ads will come into play. Then, like that old film, I will have to exit through the nearest opening, your roomy eye probably, before I run out of tea for time. I can simply tear it apart. Though this will be most difficult, it feels the most satisfying. Begin with cutting the beautiful strings, then rip off the valve lips like so many yogurt lids, finally work my hands bloody like crying in a swimming pool, taking the central divide asunder. Yes, how satisfying to gut it like that, so nothing can hide. Sometimes I feel so much strength that I think I could reach in under your straining ribcage with my bare hand and pluck the grotesque, pulsating thing out like a weed. But they beat independently, and I can't imagine not flinging it away in disgust, not screaming and stamping like a child with an eel, not cowering in the corner while the pathetic lump convulses its last. The book says to make sure and come out before the drumbeat stops. I'm not sure what happens otherwise. Thank you.
I'm going to be reading Geraldine Plunkett Dillon, who is better known as her brother's editor. She's the sister of Joseph Plunkett, who was executed in 1916. Geraldine Plunkett Dillon lived Wisconsin, 1993. Thanks. Yeah. These poems were sent by her great-granddaughter, and she was known in her family as Mama. And I haven't really introduced her properly. She was a founding member of Tauk Nagalava. She was a poet. She was a contributing writer to Encyclopedia Britannica. Is that what you call her? Really got this.
I know.
Okay, I decided to read Latin on the train. So this is, there's some Latin in this. It's called Sici Amat. In my dream of peace, one sound breaks silence, the sweetness of increase, as honey downward drips, through the bars of sense, down to my soul's lips. For whose joys my heart thinks of it, shout with a loud voice, no fear or regret. Sici Amat Noyet, Hid Hac Vox Clamat. The next poem I'm going to read is Magnificat, which is the title of her book. Magnificat, a fold of heaven's curtain swung aside, splitting the blackness of the winter's night. Blown by the breath of God, it opened wide. I saw the holy ones in companies, led by archangels, armored for the fight. I heard the shrill, eternal symphonies. I did not thrust my sorrow-twisted face among the splendors of the heavenly town, nor walk misshapen with the forms of grace, girded for battle in celestial wars. And yet, my God, an angel has come down and crowned me with the glory of stars. Mm. I was just thinking about Rhoda when I was reading that line. Mm. She used laurels. Mm. I'm very organized. Okay, the book I downloaded from the internet, and anybody can download it, and I highly suggest we all do, is it like this? Thanks, Linda. June. I fill my heart with a store of memories, lest I should ever leave these loved shores, of lime trees humming with slow drone of bees, and honey dripping from sycamores. Of how a fir tree set upon a hill lifts up its seven branches to the stars. Of the grey summer heat when all is still and even grasshoppers cease their little wars. Of how a chestnut drops its great green sleeve down to the grass that nestles in the sod. Of how a blackbird in a bush at eve sings me suddenly the praise of God. And the other thing I noticed about this book, I've been editing for 9 years, is that the poems were forced into shapes that don't suit the movement of the poem. And I was wondering if that was an editorial decision. Also, there's lots of errors in printing. But it's a lovely piece. The North Wind. O rare North Wind, whose cutting edge is keen, joyfully tossing, brushing up the countryside. Tossing aloft the yellow buds and green, a little southward eddy creeps around, when all the west is blushing like a bride. Sweet is the southward eddy near the ground. The heavy tide rolls in, billows blue, save in the purple depths where seaweed lies. The seagulls out against the clouds are few, but oh, the sea is white among the rocks. The whipped foam white in the north wind flies, high in the sky, are floating the north wind flocks. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. I'm going to read one by myself, which is, I write, yeah, you can clap for it. Okay, I recorded this for, and I think and poets can do this, and I've forgotten the name of it. Poetry Jukebox up in Northern Ireland. I think we're doing a fired one solely, or this could be going into the Northern Irish agreement, which is kind of ironic when you hear it. Come, let us not build world's nests. I begin to decipher the numbers of that wild tree, those of storm-wracked hedges, their hierarchy of holes. I heard yours when you think I did not. It is of no consequence. I desire other voices, stone, the wind. Let it blow the golden net right off the grid. I was meant to stand in the sea. Decipher its grace, not to draw to you who would contain it. Turn to the alpha and beta of wind. Those stones where my feet have fallen are worn from treading. Tongues of trees lift the golden net. Carry it off, a map of worlds unsought. Lay it down gently apart on the black grass. It is a language not mine yet. Thank you.
Be here with you today, especially as an American poet, celebrating these women who have given so much in word and gift, a vision, and yet for many are not remembered. But we're going to change that today. So.
Woo!
And we will continue changing that. So the poet that I chose was Edna Strong, who was born in West Limerick and came to work in Dublin in 1942. That year, her first published poetry in Irish appeared in Anglore. In 1943, she was a founder member of the Runa Press, a struggling outlet for many poets. She then had 9 children.
Oh.
9. The youngest who required full-time care because of a disability. She combined family care with writing, taking a degree in Trinity College, Dublin, and teaching for 12 years. Writing in both Irish and English, her work appeared in many magazines, journals, anthologies, published in Ireland and abroad. They had been broadcast in radio, translated in French and Italian. Her first novel, Degrees of Kindred, came out in 1979, followed by a collection of short stories, Patterns, and she had 6 books, collections of poetry. So it's an honor to read her work. I'm going to read 2 poems, but I need some help to read the first one because it's in Irish and then there's a translation. So I do not speak Gaelic. I do many things, but I do not have that wonder in my grasp. So, Kathy, will you help me? Okay. Yep.
I think we'll start with the original, right?
Oh, okay. This is my first time actually ever reading poetry Oscar again to a microphone, so bear with me. An fair nach stoppig. In mlíne tá láb in uchtar ag an bhéarúin. Níor bhuelig ar a os ó bhí mórta, mé ag ôm a chud alish ag stracha leis an meisín bacha bunta. Bhís ag ceapa go bhaing sos om úl, báth is seisca béidir, ach ní raibh lá gan bhóisteach a brostu an ostra, is a rish mother la lunasa, vishin eran lunasa, belicha is star an chaid. Chach than oer a dwort, beg tersha eran ver, rocky gachola, ligig ski. Och biog boil man for der for, be eid na mina be green for a fosling, cor chiach lo, nor lane, och a yol an glas for la gwilla. Nuv la sauna, wigis an air. Os glím na dhórse, líonam grian an pasáiste a bhí grúma an níis beag, las muig é líon an fórver. Dlóga in is gehán ar falún nó go socrín go réig orga ar an bhéir atá glas, bíagach mar an arach.
The year of the grass. This year the grass got the better of me. It has not stopped growing since March, and I've been sweating like a pig, struggling with my buckety lawnmower. I was thinking I might get a break around July, a dry spell. Possibly, but each day rain came, bringing on the growth, and then again, as to August, that was the wettest August of the century. Come autumn. I thought, the grass will be tired, it will rest, go to sleep, but not a bit of it. September, October, they were the sunniest months yet. Just the odd shower, which the grass sucked down, then sprang. Today, November day. The air is soft. I open door. Sunshine amazes. The passage sullen a moment, since outside autumn steals about. Leaves as wings float to settle gently their yellow on the grass, which is vivid, thrusting like a like the spring. It was good for me. I was reading the text and be like, I know that word. That word. I know. One more poem. Yellow joke. I have a great liking for the ridiculous. The way it makes a fatal hole in solemnity, letting in the light of laughter, the sky cracked and there was a huge laughing. Lightning ridicules, splitting pompous clouds, rending their bloated threat to the splendid mockery of thunder. The elemental hilarity of crazy rain. Let us enjoy the banana skin. Bringing dictators to the ground. That poem and that couplet in particular sung for me. I don't think you have any wonder why. And so I read one poem of my own. It's called Band Portrait in the MAGA, Make America Great Again, era. And it actually has a number of erasures, which you won't be able to see, but I'll read some of them. And they're my medical records. So it took my husband, we went through a fertility treatment. So it took him just one attempt and 2 days to get his medical records. It took me 3 official forms, 2 phone calls, 4 weeks to get mine. Reina León, female, born, infertile. Just days ago, I saw the label for the first time. Infertility as me, my problem. Retroverted uterus, a defect symptom, though utterly normal in 25% of women. My fault. A crib remains unbought. It is always a woman open, speculum wide enough to hold a blame. Allergies. Gluten. Hazelnuts. Lactase. Latex. Nuts. Peanut oil. Tomato. The doctor's notes are coded and hidden. My husband has no such markers. His record is given with ease. Whiteness is in the asking only once. And what is available, I learned. I am allergic to the world. Tired of clay, Ava arose from strategic packaging. Ava is a watch you can wear for fertility stuff. First woman, contained in chips and LED lights. Green equals charged. Red equals not. Blue equals Eden is on fire. I am proud in a world that wishes to stifle the earth. She tells me the secrets that I want to know. Take charge of your cycle with Ava. No other cycle tracker detects 5 fertile days per cycle or provides insight about sleep, stress, and resting heart rate. Just $200. And I paid. She tells me that I haven't been sleeping, that I have a lot of stress. Ava does not read the news. She prefers to be passive, Arctic flu. Would you like a spreadsheet of rising temperatures that bode well for the luteal phase? She does that Excel devilry too. I dream that there are these sacs, curved like bison skulls, full where the eye hollows would be. Inside, orbs glow like little backyard bulbs on invisible wires wound round a tree. But inside, instead of forked filaments, braided cordage. Each one holds sons and daughters. Sun shells are ended songs. Daughter rongers reveal a coiling with a frayed end that look close at them and see how they extend through growing bodies. Generations of daughters link through their centers. I put my own thumb at my navel to touch a tremulous future. a glimmering film just beyond which is the daughter of my daughters of my daughters, and on her face dust as I was a particle within my grandmother's caring. We women are born magic. All over that we will ever have within us, may I be holder of generations. We tried the IUI, we tried again to polyps, little pills that grew exponentially like killing seeds. 90% of women are just fine. A hysteroscopy with the good drugs, just fine. The doctors couldn't give me studies about women like me. And I remember my grandmother's nerve spire cancer starting in the uterus they didn't remove with rotted ovaries. That could be me. But when the radiology tech sounded the ultrasound bell against the walls in me, they found nothing. I listened to the twangy beeps and looked at the astral film, hoping for some reason we had all missed it. A miracle. Twins. Like polyps.
What?
No. I dream again of coins of all sizes stacking around me. They ache the bureau to creak and raise my bath to the brim. They fall from a sex must bed when I turn, and they clog my nostrils in copper and dry night air. They glitter in my navel like a poor woman's jewel. We flavor our tea with nickel. All the coins we've gathered to pay for some other man's drugs. Clomid once with his masked fog. I could not read or stay awake or sleep, though fatigued. Then letrozole, the pebble cedar with its seductive ease, and overdrill, both times, a shot to trigger. Will I have corpses for sons and daughters with barbed wire around their homelands? Follicles to pop a few potentials. How surprising the needle, painless, and in fat, the slow crawl of the plunger and the taste of metal fillings in my mouth. Thank you.
Galway convent girl alone in 1890s Dublin, Mary Devonport O'Neill went on to establish herself as a writer and one of the literati of the Irish Free State. During the 1920s, she would often take afternoon tea with W.B. Yeats. In the 30s, she would hop onto a tram from Rathgar into town for a chat with Sybil de Burquet, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and spent days in her Kenilworth Square drawing room plotting movement directions for Ninette de Valois. She was a salon hostess, artist, poet, and playwright who glitters and yet remains half seen. Her name is sometimes misspelt or repeated incidentally in stories about other personalities of this era, also like W.B. Often inadvertently disparaging, these accounts refer to her as wife of a highly ranking civil servant who socialised with Dublin's political and cultural elite. She celebrated Proust in her poetry, quick-witted, intellectual and in tune with Irish modernism as well as the Celtic revival. Many of her ideas incorporated both new Western understandings of the human psyche and the ancient Eastern doctrine of karma. She was a woman of formidable literary ability and artistic talent, and I'm sure I'm not the only one here tonight who had never ever heard of her. This poem is called The Crooked Slice of Bread, and she said that it comes from a dream she had that she was so impressed by that she decided to write it down. The convent parlor with a floor of shining boards and a glass garden door, a wide ring of slippery chairs, saints on the wall, a young saint with a skull, an old saint, thin with prayers, seashells upon mats of coloured wool, an oval table set with bread and wine the colour of foxglove, and little vases, such as children dress their altars with in May. In these I poured the wine. But why did he who got the first vase shove his vase away? I stopped pouring the wine. And then, as if a rain cloud spoke, he said, "You've given me a crooked slice of bread." I turned and found a loaf so stale and dry it was hard as sandstone, and a knife as thin and waving as a blade of grass. And then, while centuries seemed to pass, all things had faded but the task I tried. Do I, in some less culpable life that slides along one side of this, using force and strength I miss in this life here, work hard instead to cut that straight, smooth, even slice of bread?
There is more. She's got quite a lot of short poems. I said I'd gift us with quite a few of them. This one's called Dead Women, because, I mean, who are we celebrating here tonight? You dead women in your graves, you made beauty long ago. But unceasing waters flow, and great unattending waves carry all things that we know. And they wither and grow old. Are you nothing now but mold? Cold and brown. You, who were more bright than a crown, and amethyst and emerald, and all that gorgeous red and yellow gold. This one I would like to personally dedicate to T.D. Michael McGrath. It's called Strong Wind. 'Tis a strong wind would blow always in one way. The wind today blows up from the river. 'Tis a strong wind would blow one way forever, and there's no such wind. And I've got to say, I absolutely love this poem, and it really resonates with me. It's called An Old Waterford Poem. On the road overhead to the passers-by, "Listen," she said, "inside this cliff are the dead. They cry because they are dead." "You hear," said I, "the cry of the wind in the hollow face of the cliff. Within the cliff there is only earth." "And what," said she, "are the dead but earth?" I'd like to read a couple of my poems. This one I felt was kind of particular to this project. It's called Voiceless. I am voiceless. I speak of trees and bark. The ashes of conversation float and settle in my hair. Confetti for all those dead poets sent bravely to the grave. I am voiceless. My face speaks for me. The modern woman of today, empowered only in my choice between lipstick shades and glitter. Oh, I'll be loved, and loved well, that is, until the first wrinkles set in. You may be king of banks and stones and every blooming thing, but I am voiceless. I speak of trees and bark. This one, I'm afraid, has a trigger warning for assault. It's called Naptoyoshka. Sometimes, all it takes is a look. You go back in on yourself. A Naptoyoshka for every event. Size independent of proportion. A good way to measure self-esteem, nonetheless. Every woman has this list. Some things seem trivial. Your dad's business partner insisting on being kissed goodnight. You, 8 years old in your nightie, wishing mom and dad would let you off the hook. Some things are bigger. The first time your boyfriend thrusts his burning penis in your hand. When he waits until you are drunk enough to teach you the ways of men. Pats you on the head afterwards. Calls you a good girl. It's not each moment on its own. It's the mise-en-scene of a whole lifetime. where events cup each other like chips in a tube. You go inward, strip layers down, to find that the kernel is a grain of rice, that one's whole life amounts to being a vessel for a tinier, neater version of oneself, that one's whole life can be measured by the hands and laws of men.
I'm going to be reading some poems by Sheila Wingfield. She was born in 1906 to a very privileged background, and she married the Viscount Powers Court, if you know Powers Court outside of Dublin. She went to Rodine School in the UK, which is a very very well-known girls' school. She married in 1932. She published her first collection of poetry called Poems in 1938 and went on to publish seven collections in total, including the long poem Beat Drum Beat Heart in 1946, which I think was her response, I think, to the Second World War. Her husband was, I think, a prisoner of war, and I think that can really kind of concentrate the mind. John Betjeman declared in the foreword to our first collection that this is a book which only a woman can write, but which a man can enjoy. A fourth collection of Kites in a One, the Poetry Book Society Choice Award in 1955, and she had a difficult relationship, I think, with Yeats. He wrote her a personal letter when he praised her book poetry, and then she used it as the blurb without permission, and he didn't like that at all. Didn't like her stealing his words. And they say we die two deaths. One when we actually die, and one when we're forgotten. So don't let these women poets now die again. So the first poem is a very short one. It's called Winter, and it's from the first collection. The tree still bends over the lake, and I try to recall our love which had a thousand leaves. The second one is from the book that I mentioned, where she's kind of responding to the Second World War, and this is a very long poem. This is from part three, an extract from Women in Love. Clearly as a fife and drum down the village lane may come, as bells may suddenly be hurled on willow, and the ash tree sweeps into greying gusts of fear, as it rains, as starts the wren, or suddenly a maiden weeps, so is caring ever near, ever hidden. We who watch a woodman split a tree to its pale heart, at any breath may feel love with one heavy blow, cleaving us from head to toe. Then life and the whole sky turn chill and set us shivering, as when Europa with her friends at play in hot, sweet, sultry fields, away by the great creamy bull was led along a bitter shore, until her hair was lifted by the wind, and over the dark ripples sped the two to rough-topped Crete. Even the aging, the wise-eyed, the disenchanted women, those most unassailable whose prose of peace is rounded them like a dress, even the unforgetting ones could let no further pain compress their lives, and those whose memory is faded like a token saved, that letter or that strand of hair which has lost all its power and sense, as on a wall a sword can hang quite disregarded, yet engraved with battle honours of the past, and rust eats out what was immense. They'll feel its touch, and those who've tried to act like vagabonds dispersed in public gardens,
through May's hush will find the dark red hawthorn flush and warmth. We'll know the pang and fear of couples who year after year shelter beneath it, stand in thrall without a word, and wait for the first thunderdrops to fall. I think I'm going to stop there. The last one, which shows her nastier side. I think she, reading about her, she sounded like she'd be quite difficult to live with. And this one reminded me of a recent book by Nora Ephron, the writer. She's a film writer, called "I Feel Bad About My Neck." So this is called "Baby Song." Oh, cradled daughter. Oh yeah, and it has this thing in it called dancing water, right, which I didn't know what it was, and this is something that doesn't exist and has never existed. It's a fairy elixir to give back lost youth. Okay. Baby song. Oh, cradled daughter, no dancing water will make you young when your dimpled arm and rounded neck look scraggy and wrung. Provided no harm, my darling queen, should come in between. No hint of such wreck as I have suffered and seen. Now I'll hush my tongue. Mm-hmm. Let's hear it for Sheila. Thank you. And then I've a couple of poems. This is just a love poem, just to kind of soften up. Let's go driving. Let's go driving nowhere, love. The skies are bursting, the moon is young. Turn up the heat, demist the glass, flick the wipers double time to catch your pulse and mine. Let's leave behind the orange glow, clear the front until all we can see ahead is stars. And then this last one is I went to see the Terracotta Army. I don't know if anyone ever seen it. Amazing. And they have soldiers, and they all have a different face, and they're made in terracotta, and they're man size. And then they have they have geese and horses and stuff. It was really good. But then I was walking around, I suddenly realised there's something really big missing. And then this poem, I've done this before where we have a call and response. So I'm going to say, where are the women? And you're going to say, where are the women? Okay?
Yay.
So we'll practice. Where are the women?
Where are the women?
All right, that's awesome. Yet to be found. Where are the women?
Where are the women?
I asked the warrior standing eye to terracotta eye. He may have shrugged beneath his padded armour. He gazes sightless over my shoulder, watches for some long dead, long defeated enemy, thinks about some girl. Where are the women?
Where are the women?
I ask the archer. Does he have a sweetheart waiting for in his village for his return with the emperor's pay sewn into his trousers to hang his crossbow on the wall, marry and think no more of the crank, the trigger, the thunk of a bolt striking home? Where are the women?
Where are the women?
I ask the musician. He wants dancers, graceful, smiling ladies with their tiny feet tapping in embroidered slippers, trilling around him like larks. He has his eye on one whose swing of her hips could fill a man's head. Where are the women?
Where are the women?
I ask the clerk. His writing tools hang from his belt. He would note the washerwoman's pay, tally the tunics and puttees taken to the river, the exact count of pots and needles the treasury covers, itemizes the concubines who flatter and amuse the court, the immortal emperor buried in a suit of jade and pearls. Where are the women?
Where are the women?
I ask the strong man, the acrobat, the horses. I ask the government, the comedians, the judiciary, the scientists, the directors, the discussion panels, the engineers, the decision makers, the speakers, the board members, the professors, the media, the reviewers, the curators, the sports stars, the technologies, the military, the leadership. Where are the women?
Where are the women?
And no one tells me where the women are.
All right. Woo! Yeah.
I won't say much, I know we're late, but thanks very much. It's been, I think, incredibly moving for all of us to be able to give you these women's words. I hope that you visit our website at womenvoicepledge.com. I hope that you sign the pledge. I hope you tell other people to sign the pledge. And yeah, thanks very much. Woo!